And just now, as we were sitting, the thought occurred to me that nobody turned their car over on their way here this evening. Those of you who were here last Saturday will recollect that that was a notable feature of the evening's events, was that some of our visitors ended up on their car roof. The car ended up on its roof, and they were inside it on the while they were on their way here. So that was a pretty dramatic event and certainly caught all of our attention and naturally enough gave rise to some reflections on uncertainty. You know, just think you're going to pop across the road and leave your things at the neighbour's house and pop back for the evening talk, and then you find yourself trying to pop the door open upside down in the ditch. So the absence of an overturned car is not something that we really notice, is it? Sitting here quietly in the silence of the room, that quality of absence doesn't grab our attention. When things are painful or shocking or startling, exciting, then the mind immediately goes to that, takes hold of that. But the absence of anything stimulating or interesting, dangerous, irritating, then something in us starts to switch off. We don't notice that. Peace, silence, stillness are not interesting. They don't instinctually grab the attention. In one of the Buddha's main teachings about emptiness, the contemplation of emptiness, sunyata, the shorter discourse on emptiness, Chula Sunyata Sutta, the Buddha begins with this kind of reflection, thinking, you know, in this, you know, you should consider, there are, right now, here, there are no elephants and horses in this hall. We can consider the same thing this evening as well, but, there are no elephants, no horses here in the meditation hall at Abhayagiri. At least not that are apparent. Whatever Wittgenstein might have proved. But there don't seem to be any horses or elephants. No noisy crowds. And then as the Buddha proceeds through that sutta, he describes this a kind of conscious noticing of what's not present, what is absent. So we have to arouse that quality of noticing, of being attentive, because when something is startling or interesting or frightening or painful, the mind goes to that, and we can it sparks the process of investigation and attending, looking at, investigating, and that very sparking, even if it's a painful experience, can provide the energy whereby we start to contemplate or to look or to see what the mind makes out of that habitually. Running away from the frightening, trying to get rid of the painful, trying to chase after and possess the pleasant. We can see the mind doing that, arousing the different reactions and learn how to let go of them. But oftentimes when things are plain, when they are simple, when they're quiet, unremarkable, the mind gently drifts into a state of complacency. And in some respects, this quality of complacency, of dullness, that aspect of moha or delusion, can be more dangerous than, you know, reactivity of anger and aversion, of fear, of desire. Because we can regard it as comfort. We can regard it as a pleasant abiding. We can make a home there. We can drift into and a comfortable dullness. So amongst his many teachings, the Buddha warned us, or those who are interested in genuine liberation, were warned against that kind of drift, that kind of dullness, that kind of non-sensitivity, and gave encouragement to cultivate that quality of attending, even to the absences of things, just like in that wonderful discourse on emptiness, the Chula Sunyata Sutta, that he gets progressively more and more refined in what one is encouraged to notice is not present. But there's a rising up that we need to do. There needs to be a rousing of, oh look, there's no agitation going on here. There's no noisy people here this evening. Just Ajahn Amaro carrying on. There's no emergencies happening in the room. There's no argument in the room. There's no dramatic movement in the room. Now, it takes a lot of effort to arouse that quality of noticing absence, to be aware of that. Oh, look, there's nothing disturbing. Because the instinct is so strong to, if the headache's gone away, then we don't need to think about it. If the indigestion has passed, then we don't need to think about it. If the rain is on the outside and the windows and doors are all closed, we don't need to think about it. We switch off. That's the instinct. That's natural. That's just our ordinary, common, animal-based response to the flow of experience. But if we really want to know liberation rather than just a kind of dull palliative comfort, that this of course is highly dependent on there not being any rain blowing in, or any stomach ache or headache or car being turned over or any other shift of conditions that disturbs us, that is irritating or compelling or frightening or whatever. If we really want to be liberated, then the Buddha pointed to the fact that that kind of alertness, attentiveness, that kind of noticing, an active apprehension of peacefulness, of space, of emptiness, of absence, is really crucial. In his very first teaching on the Four Noble Truths, it's often pointed out that in the for each of the four truths, there is a particular way for each one to be handled, to be practiced with. So dukkha, the first truth, the truth of discontent, dis-ease, suffering, is to be apprehended, to be understood. Parinyayanti. The cause of dukkha, tanha, is to be abandoned, pahata banti. The path whereby that is abandoned, the way, the means that abandoning happens, the fourth noble truth, is to be cultivated, to be developed, bhaveta banti. And in the context of what I'm talking about this evening, for the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering, the cessation of dukkha, dukkha nirodha, is to be realized, sacchikata banti. So this is something that it's brought up and we're encouraged to look at, to refer, to develop. But it so easily drifts off the screen, doesn't it? To realize the cessation of suffering, to notice when the dukkha has ceased. Like I was mentioning the other day, you know, in the winter time, it's very hard to remember that in Abhayagiri there aren't any flies at the moment. And those of you who have been here any month between, say, April and November, know that the house flies are a very, very common experience at Abhayagiri. We've even developed our own, not yet patented fly catcher. This wonderful net. Ajahn Pasno is extraordinarily adept at using the fly net. I'm kind of cack-handed, so I'm not so good at it as him. But it's a combination of a badminton racket with a bridal veil, a net made of bridal veil. I think, why do Buddhist monastics go into the bridal shop? This, or maybe it was Beverly's, the haberdashery. But it's very rarely that we need to go to bridal stores, but this is one occasion to get the bridal veil. It's just the right consistency for the fly-catching net. So the flies are a big issue in the summertime, but you don't think when you come into the middle of winter, into the Dhamma hall at Abhayagiri, you don't think, wow, no flies. Just as you don't think, wow, you know, no wine bottles. You know, it's a monastery, Saturday night. It's not surprising that there's no bottles around. If you go to Taylor's Tavern and you saw no bottles, you know, it would be surprising. Down in the village, but here at Abhayagiri, we don't. The absence of alcohol is not surprising because it's a monastery. But it's an absence. The flies are not present. The agitation, disturbance, you know, conversations are not present. So dukkha nirodha, to be realized, is that noticing when some condition has ceased, noticing when it comes to an end, and sustaining the attention even as that condition ends. And so when we say dukkha, we often think of something painful, you know, like a stomach ache or an argument or a conflict, something, you know, harsh and negative. But in this respect, it's also important to remember that happiness is also dukkha, that delighting in your loved ones is also dukkha. Cherished beautiful possessions, wholesome objects, anything that we think of that we own, that we have, that is ours, or that is dear, the pleasant as well as the painful, and the neutral also. Anything by its very thingness is dukkha, is unsatisfactory, is incapable of providing continual, abiding, independent satisfaction. Because even if it's pleasant and beautiful and good, if the heart has tied itself to that, then it possesses what's called viparinama dukkha. It's the dukkha of this inherent in its change. The fact that, yes, this is beautiful, good, and wholesome, and pleasant, delightful, but when it's gone, when it's lost, when that person has left us, or when the thing has folded up and closed down, then the heart is left with that kind of nostalgia. It literally, it's a Greek word meaning homesickness. Now we've lost our home. The heart is pained because of that beautiful thing that was so good, that was so fine, that was so lovely, is now gone. So dukkha ceasing, when there is that pahinanti, the things have been abandoned. And that quality of painfulness has ceased, that quality of dukkha has ceased, then to realize that, to cultivate that realization, means to notice that it has ended. To stay with that even as it fades, and then after it has faded, to sustain the attention and to really acknowledge, to open the heart to fully apprehend that, oh, that suffering has ceased, that dukkha is no longer present. That was a pain, that was a pressure in the heart. It's now absent. And how does this feel? What's the experience of that dukkha ending? So that we're fully opening to that quality of dukkha ceasing. And when we do, it's rather like noticing the peacefulness. If you're one example I often give, and in is most a kind of common experience that we all have, is if you're bustling around your place and doing this and doing that, and you're just relating to a room because you're looking for a particular object, a cup or a book or something, and you can't find it here and you can't find it there, and you're just moving around with a particular task in mind. You know, the room where the book isn't or the cup isn't is uninteresting. It's not significant. There's no value, no importance. But if in the process of bustling through that empty space, if you just stop in that empty room and you pause and you just notice the space, just stand in the middle of the room for 10 seconds and let yourself know, let the heart be fully aware of the peacefulness and spaciousness there, letting the search for the cup or whatever dissolve momentarily, then that room, which was nondescript and insignificant because it doesn't hold the object that you're looking for, sort of unworthy of attention, nothing very special that we're just sort of bustling through, then that transforms. It changes, doesn't it? And you stop and pause and just let yourself be with the present, this place. And things change. It's like an opening of a flower. It's like, oh, this ugly little kind of, or not even ugly, kind of nondescript little bud suddenly opens up, and there's this extraordinary array of petals and tones and colors and fragrance. Wow, look at that. The moment opened, it blossomed. That space, it was always there. And suddenly the heart stopped and noticed it. Ah, well, that's different. But our tendency is not to do that. Our tendency with when some kind of dukkha ceases, some kind of dukkha, either very on a refined level, on a spiritual level, there's a recognition of clinging and it's been abandoned, and we see that clinging, that attachment end. Or whether it's dukkha on another level, it's an ordinary feeling like, the flies are not here, or the headache's gone, or the stomach is satisfied after a meal. The hunger has vanished because now I'm full. That we hardly even notice that. We just look for the next thing. Okay, now I've got to do the dishes. Or now I don't need to think about, oh, there's no headache. I can just carry on with my world, do my thing, and go from A to B, and take care of this letter that needs to be written, and this phone call needs to be made, and this person needs to be talked to, and off it goes. The mind just moves to the next interesting thing, the next responsibility, the next task, the next stimulation, the next worry, the next thing to be concerned about. Space is not interesting. Peace is not interesting. Silence is not interesting. So the instinct, the habit of attention, is to leap to the next thing. How many of us have had that experience whereby when you have a peaceful moment, this is another everyday experience that that we're all familiar with, where maybe you finish some task and you've been busy doing something, and you finally get it all done, and you put the things away and you plunk yourself down in a chair and you think, ah, now I can relax. And then a few moments go by, and then there's this feeling of, I should be worrying about something. I know there's something I should be worried about. Now, what is it? What can I pick up and follow? And maybe the mind doesn't spell it out in such a deliberate way, but you can feel that hunting, that searching for the next thing, looking for an object to be concerned with, to exist, for a me to exist in relationship to, so that a subject can exist in relationship to an object. There's a hunting, a searching, a kind of feverish little seeking that goes on, looking for the next thing. It's very hard to stay with peace. It's very hard to stay with emptiness, with silence, with spaciousness. Because the instinct is to look for the next thing. And it's, you know, it's part of our conditioning as animals, you know, looking for the next food opportunity, looking for the next danger, looking for the next mating opportunity, looking for the possibilities of shelter, concern for the family, who you're supposed to be protecting, or who's protecting you. Those are the instincts that the unaware mind defaults to. And if there's no particular object to grab hold of, and the mind doesn't conjure up an anxiety, then it tends to just drift into dullness, into a kind of sleep state, or a density of thinking, a kind of switching off, shutting down. So for the heart to be really liberated, this quality of sustaining attention, really allowing that quality of peace that comes with the cessation of suffering to be known. This is something that we need to develop. It needs to be consciously picked up and nurtured. It doesn't just happen on its own. The mind doesn't default to enlightenment. It defaults to ignorance. Unfortunately, it would be a lot easier if it was the other way around. But my experience is that it defaults to greed, hatred and delusion, to ignorance. In one of the verses that we chant very regularly, you often at funerals or in respect of people's passing away, we did this dedicated evening chanting to this friend of Sakula's who passed away, I think, in New York just recently. The Anicca Vata Sankara verse: all conditions, all created things, all formed things, sankara, are anicca, are transient, impermanent. Upada vaya dhammino, of the nature to arise, and vaya dhamma, to cease, to fall away. They rise up, they fall away. Upajitava nirujanti, having come into being, then they dissolve. They nirujati, they cease, like nirodha is related to nirujati. Having come into being, then they end. Te sang upasamo sukho. And in their passing, there is sukha, there is contentment, peace, happiness. That's the potential that is present. When a condition ceases, if the heart is truly awake and truly attentive, then there is peacefulness, there is sukha, there is true contentment, happiness. But we don't allow ourselves that. The habit is to miss that, and we just chase after the next interesting thing or frightening thing, or we conjure up an object to fill that space just because of blind habit. I remember reading some years ago, I forget exactly where this came up, but it was a child, it was in the context of I think it was a child's essay or something they wrote for their school homework. And they described that the way that they got to know God was listening to the sound of a bell and following the sound when the bell was struck, listening to the sound of the bell when the sound had faded away. And this kid said, and if you keep listening when the sound has faded away, that's the same as knowing God. I thought, who is this kid? That's a bright kid. That's very, very insightful. You know, where these intuitions, these flashes of wisdom come from. And I think it's like the kid was like 10 or 11 years old, you know, not terribly old at all, but had somehow this deep intuition that was the way to at least they found to know God or to know that truth or that fundamental formless perfect quality that is ever present and utterly ineffable, that is pure and peaceful and utterly intangible. The one way to find that is that you take a condition like a sound of a bell, and then attending to the sound, and as the condition fades, sustaining that listening, that attending. And the sound ceases, but the attending remains. And then there's awareness, there's knowing. And the more full and clear that is, then the less that's a me listening to nothing. And there's simply awareness of this moment. Not grasping any condition, not pushing anything away. And also, you know, the more and more we develop it, then even if the bell rings again or other things happen, you know, even thoughts come or we hear different noises or there's different feelings, then that same attending, objectless, subjectless awareness sustains itself. And there's that consciousness, that awareness of an abiding peace that we're able to attend to that quality, we're able to know that quality, that nature of the Dhamma underlying or permeating every condition, whether it's quiet and still on the sensory level or whether it's raucous and noisy and active. The more we develop the practice, the more we develop this quality of realization, the more that we know emptiness, that fundamental, empty, still, peaceful quality that comes with the ending of dukkha, the more we fully attend to that, sustain it, then regardless of the conditions, whether there's noises beginning and ending, or feelings beginning and ending, or sights or sounds, or whatever, then the heart is able to know that basic radical quality, that basic peacefulness, that fundamental spaciousness, that emptiness within which all perceptions occur, which underlies, overrides, permeates all conditions, all perceptions, thoughts, feelings, the internal, the external, all sankharas, all forms, that's able to be known. So the heart sustains that quality of peacefulness, regardless, independent of external circumstances, or independent of internal circumstances, memories or thoughts or mental activity even. That basic context of experience, that fundamental silence, spaciousness, peacefulness, that energetic, silent attentiveness is sustained, that is known. So one way that we can develop this kind of practice is, we were talking about it the other day in one of the Dhamma readings we had, a practice that Ajahn Sumedho would often encourage, is to develop a mindfulness of endings. And this doesn't have to be just, you know, the refined attention to clinging, ceasing within the heart, the attachment to a thought or a feeling or a mood. But this functions just as well. It's like developing a sense, a noticing of ending of things. So this can be just like noticing that a sentence is ending. Or a feeling in the body. Oh, I had that ache in my left knee, then I recrossed my legs, and now my left knee doesn't ache anymore. That ache has finished. Well, now it's night time. It was day, and the day seemed so real and absolute, and now the day is finished, and it's now night time. That day has ended. So just noticing that quality of things completing. Just making that a reference point, flagging that kind of quality. Consciously noticing absences. And just as in the Buddha's reflections in the Chula Sunyata Sutta, you know, coming into the meditation hall and recognizing, oh look, no elephants, no horses, no armies, no marketplace, no crowds of people. To notice the ending of a mood. Oh look, you know, I was so upset and uptight about that this morning, and I can't even remember what it was I was upset about now. That mood ended. Or a feeling, oh, I really wanted a cup of tea, and then now I've had a cup of tea, and then now that craving for tea has ended because it's been fed. So this can be you can develop this around very coarse, simple objects. You know, it's just ordinary mechanical experiences. Just seeing the way that things cycle. They come into being, they seem to have a solid, real existence, and then they end. And when they end, then what's it like once they've finished? What is that? How does that feel? What's the texture of that? What's the experience of that? And then, just mapping the same pattern of experience, not just with sense objects and coarse elements, but also mapping it within. Just with moods, or seeing the more refined nature of experience, seeing that actually as dukkha nirodha, where the mind is loosing its grip on an experience, something cherished that's pleasant, or something that's hated that's painful, or something that's uninteresting that's neutral. The mind no longer being swept up in that, drifting along with that, chasing after it or contending against it. just the seeing the result of that letting go, noticing that. When we stop wanting that painful memory to be there, we allow ourselves to accept it. What happens in the heart? How does that feel? What's that like? So that we are able to really rejoice in, to appreciate what's the results of our skillful practice. Because sometimes we can work for years and years developing all kinds of good qualities in the meditation. Learning to concentrate, learning to develop insight, learning to let go. But we're so busy chasing after the next object and letting go of it that we never actually taste the fruits of having let go. There's plenty of doing of the right action, of wholesome activity, plenty of kusala kamma, plenty of proper cultivation, but we're never actually tasting the fruits of what we're cultivating. we're not enjoying the results of the practice. We're just developing a big kind of fruit storage unit. Huge refrigerated fruit store. Filled with grapes and peaches, but it's like, hey, the whole point is to be able to liberate the heart, to free the heart from suffering, so that it's needful to really fulfill that, to enjoy the results of the good that's been done, to know that, to let ourselves taste that and rejoice in that. So this is a simple kind of recollection, and to set that intention at the beginning of a day. This is something I've done a lot of over the years. To set the intention at the beginning of a day, I will make it my intention to notice endings, to see that quality of cessation, to notice that, and just to see how long I can stay with that. How can it be noticed? What pulls the mind away? What is it that arises that doesn't allow that to sustain itself? That says, but this is more interesting. Well, that's really dangerous. Well, that shouldn't be that way. I've got to look after this. I can't just hang around noticing space. I've got important things to do. I've got places to go. I've got people to talk to. I gotta. That's the becoming. Bhava tanha, always chasing after the next thing, compulsively leaning into the next thing. So to be aware of that, to know that. So this kind of practice can be extremely helpful, just setting up that simple reflection so that there's an attending. Also, it doesn't necessarily just have to be around the faculty of cessation, or the element of cessation, nirodha. Yeah. It's really mainly to do with counteracting that drift into complacency, the ordinariness of the moment, the unremarkable nature of the moment. That it's to cultivate a sharpness of attention, a crispness, a brightness of attention to the present. And so that that drift into just automatic activity, just following along in a familiar track, and also living in a monastery, we can be particularly prone to that. We have a very routine life. We have a very systematized way of relating, of doing, of acting. We have very set daily patterns of things. So it's very easy to become institutionalized. We become complacent. We just drift into a following of a pattern, of a habit, and then obedience to that pattern becomes synonymous with good practice. It becomes familiar, it becomes ordinary, we become non-resistant to it, and we call that right practice, samāpatipadā. But actually, even though it can be pretty innocent in some respects, it can just be the mindless repetition of conditioned behaviors. And, you know, we're not here just to learn pattern, you know, particular behavior forms, learn how to develop monastic behaviors or Buddhist behaviors. Just learning how to recite Buddhang Saranang Gacchami and learn how to bow properly and do all the right moves, because they are helpful conditions, but they don't liberate on their own. They can only liberate if they are truly known and understood, truly seen as they are in the present. So, any kind of reflection that helps us to sustain that awareness is going to be helpful. The awareness of the drift into complacency or dullness or a kind of over-familiarization or a kind of automatic quality. That, and things that cause that alertness in the present to be aroused. So other kinds of reflection that I've used is just to set the intention to notice, say, anicca, impermanence, uncertainty. Just at the beginning of the day, just to continually reflect upon that. And not just that you're repeating anicca like a mantra, you know, like anicca, 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 anicca. But more just to flag that, to cultivate that, the anicca sanya, the awareness of impermanence, so that you go up, you approach a door and you recollect, I don't know what's on the other side of this. Who knows what's on the other side of this door? I think it's the door into the house, or I think it's, you know, the door into the laundry room. But who knows what's on the other side? This could be suddenly there's a space warp and you walk into a different universe. There's a parallel world behind there. Any of you who've read the His Dark Materials trilogy of Philip Pullman, there's this continual moving between parallel universes through these little doorways that get opened up. Now you might think I'm drifting off into a gross imaginative riff here, but who knows? Who knows what lies behind that door Tan Ahingsaka is sitting in front of? You know, that used to be the monk's room. Maybe there could be a rhinoceros in there by now. We don't know. I mean, this is kind of perhaps getting a little bit over-imaginative. But even so, you know, just opening the door and then suddenly there's somebody standing the other side of it. Oh, you know, you were on your way to go and get a, you know, an object, and then suddenly, oh, there's a being, there's a human. Didn't expect that. How many times in the day do we assume that things are going to unfold in a particular pattern? Just to recollect, you don't know. You're walking down the hill, you don't know if you're going to get there. You're driving to the monastery, you don't know if you're going to get there. You get into your car, you don't know if the ignition key is going to start the engine or not. You pick up the phone, you don't know if the phone's going to work. Anicca, anicca, anicca. Just to keep reflecting on that, to develop that perception, that wakes us up to the moment. It counteracts that drift into dullness, the drift into complacency. Because we don't know. It's not like you're inventing it, or that suddenly you're plastering over this layer of anicca-ness over an actually basically stable and predictable universe. We're not adding, this is not an add-on. This is not an optional extra. This is the fact. This is the reality of it. So it's not something that you're inventing or kind of fabricating. It's an awakening to the already existent truth. You know, it's not known, it's not certain. Anything can happen at any time. It's not predictable. Also, other kinds of reflections. You know, I was looking at the Dhamma talk that was given when we visited Ajahn Jandi's monastery in Chonburi back in January. Ajahn Pasano and myself and the lay ministry group, and we were all in Thailand together, and Thanachan Jandi was talking about the way that Lumpo Cha would encourage simple resolutions, like basic resolutions in terms of spiritual training, to help guide us or sustain the practice. And one he mentioned in particular was one of Ajahn Chah's favorite aphorisms, which was "Eat little, sleep little, talk little." Non noi, put noi, chan noi. So, and Ajahn Chah used to love having these little notices hanging up in the trees and sort of around about the monastery, these little sort of Dharma reminders, sort of decking the forest. So just taking a simple recollection like that, eat little, sleep little, talk little. Whether one's a layperson or a monastic, you can still be an effective reflection. Like, why do I talk so much? Do I need to talk so much? When I eat, how do I relate to the food? You know, what's the right amount? Sleep. Yeah, I really like to sleep. So nice. Even Ajahn Mahabua, the great arch Maha ascetic of Thailand, he's been known to sign his letters to his kind of Dharma correspondence with his disciples, the old monk who loves his pillow. I remember reading that thinking, I can relate to that. Sort of a dearness to one's pillow has, and that feeling of when we stretch out and loosen the limbs and just let the world fade away. Just to take a simple reflection like that, to hang that up in our metaphorical or actual tree, eat little, sleep little, talk little. So that as we go about our day and we do our thing, then that is like a mirror that shines that back. And as we're in the process of living and doing our thing, then these kind of reflections help wake us up to that drift into habit, into compulsiveness, into unconsciousness, into familiarity. Yeah, how much is enough? What is the right amount to eat? How do I relate to this food? Do I take it as, you know, automatically mine, that I have a right to, and that I judge this as good and that as bad, and I want this for me? I'm more important than the others. I gotta have this for me. Where does that come from? What's that based on? Do I need to be driven by that? What do I do with my speech? How do I relate to others? How honest am I? Do I know when to stop? When I said enough? Do I know when to just... I've got a juicy story to pass on, some hot gossip, some really interesting piece of news. Can I just sit on it? Does the world have to know this? Does the world really need to know that one of the guys who got arrested for the biggest heist ever in the history of Britain came from my home village, Staplehurst? I didn't need to pass that on, did I? Avayagiri would have functioned quite happily without you all knowing that one of the guys who's helping the police with their inquiries was a car salesman from Staplehurst, which is 3 miles from where I grew up. We can leave it aside. So these kind of reflections, this way of considering, this establishing a standard, a resolution, it wakes us up. It sharpens our attention. Keeping the precepts similarly. All these are different forms and structures to help sustain that attentiveness, to cut through the power of avijja, of ignorance, the drift into habit, into repetitiousness. Just repeating the cycles, the drift into rebirth. Yes, that very drift is the engine of samsara. It is endlessness. Samsara is endlessness. It's that which keeps on going. It keeps on going because of that unconsciousness, that unawareness. When there's awareness, when there's vijja, when there's knowing, then that's the stopping of the cycle. That's the ending of the cycle of samsara. Also, maybe the final thing to say in this is that when we really start to observe that cessation of conditions, the cessation of dukkha, then the whole view of what's occurring, the reality of things, starts to shift, and we see that rather than just there being an actual, real, absolute dukkha that existed and now it's not existent and its absence is good, that very apprehension of the fundamental peacefulness, stillness, silence, it also reveals a kind of timelessness and also the insubstantiality of conditions, so that dukkha is only real and solid if we impart that solidity to it. When that quality of vision is sustained, when the vijja is sustained, then it's known that dukkha is only an appearance of things. It's a seeming. It's not actual. Dukkha is a noble truth. It's not an absolute truth. It's only a seeming based upon ignorance, not seeing clearly. When there's clear seeing, when there is vijja, then what is recognized is that actually there is no dukkha. There's not really any arising and ceasing. There's no thing that arises and ceases. That thingness is just an appearance. It's a seeming. There isn't really anything that arises and ceases, that comes into existence and then ends. It's just a pattern. We say a wave arises and ceases, but actually it's the sea the whole time. You isolate a little bit of it and you call it a wave and you can see it rising and ceasing, but that's only from a relative point of view. So that quality of peace is not a matter of trying to make the conditions end, but it's more that the fundamental peace comes from the seeing, the knowing of all conditions as fundamentally empty. That there is in this moment nothing, no thing which actually comes to be. There is no thing which actually ceases to be. That thingness is an imputed quality. It's just the events of consciousness, the patterns of perception. So there's no birth and death to be brought to an end. No thing is being born, no thing is dying. That's just a seeming. It's an appearance of things. It's not a fundamental reality. So that It's not like we were really born and then we will really die. That, even on the physical level, that's, it's always just been a seeming, an appearing. And that which is fundamental, that which is the basis, that which is the nature of reality, Dhamma itself, is intrinsically free from birth and death. It's not being born, it's not dying, it's not tied up with time in any way. So that, you know, we talk about conditions arising and ceasing, but it's important to bear in mind that's just a relative way of talking, like the sun, saying the sun rises, the sun sets. The sun doesn't rise and set, the earth spins. When you let go of that position of being on the planet, you take the position of the sun instead, then there's no rising and ceasing. There's an abiding at the center. There's a being of Dhamma. The Dhamma is realized, is known. There's that recognition of being Dhamma. And then the spinning of the earth can be seen. The spinning of happiness, unhappiness, gain, loss, praise, criticism, health, sickness, pain, pleasure, neutral feeling, like the spinning of the earth and the other planets, you know, all around. But the heart instead abides like the sun, you know, in this, I mean, all metaphors, all similes are relative, but in this metaphor, abiding at the center, being still, radiant, peaceful. And then the conditions come and go, spin and do their thing, but the heart is free from that, is unentangled in that. As they say, what does the sun know of its rising and setting? So I offer these words for consideration this evening.